Hello, and welcome to SISL Presents, a language and literacy podcast. We are the Center for the Interdisciplinary Study of Language and Literacy at Northern Illinois University. I am Megan Andrzejewski, graduate assistant for SISL, and we are joined today by one of our wonderful SISL co-directors and content expert, Dr. Allison Gladfelter. Dr. Gladfelter is an associate professor in the School of Allied Health and Communication Disorders. Before coming to NIU, she received her PhD and clinical master's degree in speech-language pathology from Purdue University. She has also worked clinically on an interdisciplinary diagnostic team at the Riley Hospital for Children in Indianapolis. Dr. Gladfelter teaches courses on social communication skills, including the social communication implications for children exposed to maltreatment. Her research explores language acquisition and motor skills in autistic children, with the ultimate goal of developing more evidence-based language interventions. She is also a founder and facilitator for the NIU Autism Caregiver Group. Today, we are thrilled to welcome and be joined by the amazing Dr. Yvette Hyder. Dr. Hyder is a speech-language pathologist with ASHA honors and a professor emerita at Western Michigan University, who is focused on trauma-informed and culturally responsive practices. She has co-authored a textbook on culturally responsive methods and edited a book on language research and post-traumatic stress. Her work also focuses on social pragmatics in African American children. She co-directs the Resiliency Center for Families and Children. She owns Language and Literacy Practices, LLC, and a Trauma Institute for Children and Communication. She is a founding member of the SLHS Equity Action Collective, whose members established an open access journal, the Journal of Critical Students of Communication and Disability, and who are transforming scholarship, practice, and policy using critical science, equity, and social justice. Thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Yvette, I'm so thrilled to have you today. I'm really excited for this conversation and to learn more about your research. Before we dive into the research, would you mind telling us a little bit more about your background?
Sure. I don't know how far back you want me to go, but I was in fifth grade when I learned about speech pathology, which it was called then. This was in the 70s. And it was a career day, and, you know, I was out into puzzles and languages, and I just had such a fascination with words. And the librarian asked me what I liked to do every day, and so I told her that, and she pointed me toward speech pathology. And when I read the little card, this was like a real card, right, in a card deck. So when I read the card, I was blown away, and I was like, this is what I want to be when I grow up. Well, my parents, being who they are, they got me an experience being a candy striper in a hospital, and I was shadowing a speech-language clinician, and my job was, this must have been over the summer, my job was to read to a child who was a little boy who was in a coma. When he came out of the coma, my voice was the only voice he recognized, and that just did it for me.
Yeah.
I was like, this is what I have to do.
Yeah.
And so that's how I got interested in speech language. And my very first job at the master's level was working in a preschool. I was an itinerant speech language clinician in Florida. But I had an opportunity to work in a preschool with a transdisciplinary team. It was not called transdisciplinary at that time, but by this time it was in the 80s. And we worked together, the special education teacher, the play therapist, me as a speech-language clinician, and a teacher's aide with children, and I'm using air quotes here, who were diagnosed as being severely emotionally disturbed. I know now that those children had a history of trauma, but the experience was so, rewarding and moving, and I've always sort of had a heart for people who are hurting, and it just felt right. Mm-hmm. So I spent the rest of my career trying to reproduce that experience.
Mm-hmm. Is that experience what got you mostly interested in your research then on trauma and its role in communication?
Yes, that experience, and I also worked with children who were, air quotes again, considered to be juvenile delinquents. Mm. These were children who, these were adolescents that were living in out of home in a residential center. All this happened in Florida. I had these experiences. And, you know, the perception of the students was very negative. So if you read something on paper or you heard someone talk about them, it was always such a negative light. But my experience of them, and I recognize it was a one-on-one, it wasn't in a classroom, but my experience of them was so different, right? So I guess I was able to see beyond their behavior. Mm-hmm. To the human being that was there struggling. And it wasn't until 2000 that I actually had a word to describe that. So in the trauma team that I co-founded at Western, that we used to say that this child is just trying to survive.
Mm.
Right? So you, mm-hmm. instead of saying what's wrong
mm-hmm.
with you, you ask, you know, what happened? And kind of just reframing it in my mind that this is survival behavior
mm-hmm.
that any of us would be doing, right? Mm-hmm. If we had the type of history they had or the anxious, the stressed brain
mm-hmm.
that you have once you've had experiences or exposure to trauma, any of us would be behaving in the same way.
Mm-hmm. That seems like such a foundational shift. Instead of what's wrong with you, instead frame it as what happened. It,
mm-hmm.
as a researcher too, and a clinician, that changes the types of questions that you ask.
Yes.
And I presume it probably shifted how you proceeded with your practice too.
Absolutely. And actually that phrase I got from one of the parents that brought, I think the child was a foster child. I'm not sure if she adopted child or not, but she was talking about her child, and she said, you know, I have to, instead of asking what's wrong, I need to ask what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, mm-hmm. you know, just mind blown
mm-hmm.
With that phrasing. And then I had colleagues who wrote an article focused on, I can't remember what they called it, but it's like a paradigm shift.
Mm.
And so there's a graphic of You can think about this behavior as willful,
mm.
as disobedient, as needing to be punished or needing,
mm-hmm.
you know, to be managed.
Mm-hmm.
And you set up this cycle, or you can reframe your thinking about the behavior and recognize, oh, this child is trying to survive. How mm-hmm. can I support them
mm-hmm.
in, you know, being safe
mm-hmm.
And collaborating with them to find a way that we can work together and move forward.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really just sets up a whole different way of thinking about the child. We did a school intervention project, I want to say 2004, 2005, and we were in a classroom, and this was a classroom in a school that had a high need. It was high numbers of children who were being suspended or expelled. Mm. Children were being sent to the office for misbehavior. There were all kinds of difficulties that the teachers were having, and we went in and we created this school intervention program. It was grant funded, and worked with the teacher to help build safety, to help the children recognize, you know, how they were feeling in their bodies and be able to communicate about that.
Mm-hmm.
The expulsion rate, the suspension rate went down. Children were taking the initiative and asking to go talk to a counselor
mm-hmm.
with their friend who they weren't getting along with. And so that was happening as opposed to them getting kicked out
mm-hmm.
of class. And so it didn't, like our pre and post tests, we never published a study, but our pre and post tests did not show any differences in the child's reporting of their trauma symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
But we have this other anecdotal
mm-hmm.
evidence that children, that something was happening because the suspension rate, expulsion rate was way down. And then children, instead of fighting, were asking to go talk it out. You know, so that was pretty huge.
It sounds like they felt safe.
Right. They felt safe. Yeah. And we think that's also why their before and after assessments didn't show any difference, because they probably didn't feel safe enough to be honest at the beginning, and then at the end of the intervention they probably felt safer. But that was a whole paradigm shift for the teachers to think of this, their behaviors, whatever they were, as being, you know, feeling unsafe and needing to survive that stress.
Yeah, awesome. That's really interesting work. I'm so curious how you think that would shift with COVID and the school closures, and if the children no longer even had access to an environment like a school where they may have felt safer.
I know. So that, I mean, some of that has been showing up, right? In some of the hospitals, the doctors have mentioned in press or in some of the print sources that the rate of children coming into the hospital having suffered abuse and neglect is down as a result of COVID. But the injuries that they were seeing were more severe. So the ones that did come in had more severe. And then if you think about it, you know, the teachers, the schools, we like to think we're really a safe place, and hopefully we are, but we're also first reporters, right? So if no one is present to report, that sets the child up for having less access to safe spaces or places where they could get a reprieve for a while, you know. So some of that has been bearing out in terms of maltreatment. But we, you know, when we think about trauma, it goes beyond maltreatment, right? So there's acute trauma, something that happens once, like a natural disaster or getting in a car accident. And you have this chronic trauma, so like war or being bullied, which happens a lot in schools. That's on the rise, being bullied. There's also complex trauma, which we've been talking about. It happens in the caregiving system. But there's also collective trauma. And, well, collective trauma and historical trauma are similar types, right? And intergenerational trauma. The historical trauma, you think about colonization or dispossession of your land or your language, that happens, that can affect people across generations. And then intergenerational trauma can be something similar, but it happens in a family line. And a collective trauma is a different type of historical trauma, so it happened in the past. And so any of those traumas, and I think about COVID, you know, the fear around, I'm still, and you saw me earlier, I'm still wearing my mask everywhere I go. And sometimes I get really strange looks, and, you know, but I have to feel safe. And that helps me feel safe. But COVID is one of those things. It's something that all of us experience, not just in the United States, but around the world. So it's collective in that way. But there were different pressures, I think, depending on where you were located. Some communities, I know that we have colleagues in West Africa, and they reported that they set up hotels. So if you were feeling a little bit sick, you went to the hotel, and the rates of infection there was really, really low. And in other places, you know, they had different ways of dealing with it. So all of that can be the fact that it was a pandemic, that it was very scary, that this is the first time most of us have ever lived through something like that, and so many people were dying, and, you know, the worry about if I get it, you know, will I die, will I survive, all that can be traumatic and leave people with that feeling of helplessness, hopelessness, this profound sense of loss. So COVID, not just the fact that children have a less, you know, children who need that safe haven may not have it all the time because schools were closed. But just the sheer fact of it being a pandemic can be traumatic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, having known people who passed away as a result could be traumatic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking about the different types of trauma that you'd mentioned, and it could almost go across them all depending on your personal situation
mm-hmm.
through it.
Yeah.
So I'm really curious to hear more about your research. So would you mind sharing what research projects you're working on right now and anything exciting in your findings so far?
Well, my main research with regard to trauma has been on social pragmatic communication. And there's quite a bit that we know that children have difficulty with language. So language comprehension, language expression, and quite a bit probably is not the right word to use. Because there is literature out there, is what I'm trying to say. But with regard to social pragmatic communication, there's not very much. I did a systematic review of the literature in 2021, and from 1974 to 2020, there were only 38 articles that focused on some aspect, not all, but some aspect of social pragmatic communication, which, you know, it's such a small amount, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we just need more. And so that's been where my focus has been. And children, I created a model. It's a conceptual model. I created it with a colleague of mine, Dr. Mark Sloan. And it's a conceptual model. It's a triangle, and it has different parts to it. And it includes all the different components of how I have conceptualized social pragmatic communication, which is that ability to read your social situation and then behave in ways that are effective or consistent with it. And it includes that in that model includes social cognition, it includes executive functioning and regulation. Executive function and regulation are in the same triangle, same little section, because they play off each other. So if you are regulated, your executive functioning is going to be better. If you're dysregulated, your executive functioning is going to be less well. At the top part of the triangle is pragmatics, which includes discourse management, presupposition skills, as well as speech acts or communicative functions. And then in the middle is memory. And so all of these components are impacted by trauma and for various reasons. And children who have who have some trauma history may have difficulty understanding why people do what they do. So reading a social situation, reading someone's facial expression, understanding other people's perspectives. They may have difficulty with executive functioning. They may have difficulty with regulation. We see that a lot, or I saw that a lot in the trauma clinic where I was working. And then the memory is fragmented often, even memory for the events that happened to them or that they were involved in. And then in terms of pragmatics, there's incoherent, that's probably not the best way to put it, but the narratives and expository texts lacked coherence, so it wasn't completely structured in a way, organized in a way that where someone could follow. The content of the expository text was incomplete. In terms of the narrative, it wasn't, or conversational discourse, excuse me, was not, they had difficulty making connections to the topic at hand.
Mm-hmm.
So comments were not relevant to the conversation that was happening. And so at every level, all aspects of social pragmatic communication, children with trauma histories are demonstrating difficulty with those areas. Who are the people who's well-positioned to work with children with social pragmatic communication, particularly pragmatics and narratives, expository texts, discourse, conversation, executive functioning. Who?
Yes.
And what's so, and I want to say this loud and clear, that we need so much more literature. We need, there are no evidence-based interventions that were developed by speech-language clinicians or scholars for this population. They have, well, maybe they have been. I developed one, but it's not published yet. Mm. So there are no published evidence-based interventions mm-hmm. for speech-language and hearing professionals. And that's, it's such a huge gap. Mm-hmm. So students, if you're interested in doing a thesis or a doctoral dissertation, please think about this as your topic. Mm-hmm. It's so important.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really interesting because could you kindly please describe the sort of rates of trauma? Is it rare? Is it common? Do you feel as though the amount of published literature echoes the amount of...
No. No. I mean, trauma, children, and the figures that I know best are the ones where there is complex trauma, so as a result of maltreatment in the caregiving system. And over 3 million children are usually investigated per year. Of those, trauma or abuse, neglect, or maltreatment is identified as substantiated for right now is less than 600,000, so close to 599, something like that, mm-hmm. thousand per year. And then of those children, the majority are children who have been neglected. And then comes physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, and human trafficking. And I also know that trauma, systemic trauma, is huge, although I don't have numbers for that. But systemic trauma, I don't know if I mentioned that earlier, but systemic trauma is what is sanctioned by society. So things like impoverishment, not having a home, houselessness, racism, and other forms of systemic exclusion, and all that systemic types of trauma, I know that affects lots of people on a daily basis. But what I tell when I'm doing public speaking, I always tell the audience that, particularly as speech-language clinicians, you have had someone on your caseload or some children or people on your caseload who have some experience with some type of trauma. That's how prevalent it is. So the literature does not match the need. Mm-hmm. And speech-language clinicians are interested, right? And but beyond knowing, okay, this is how you identify trauma, and this is how I know that, you know, I need to be trauma-informed, but what else do I do? Mm-hmm. My area of focus has primarily been on assessment. So that's where I've kind of dug down. But we need intervention studies and intervention pieces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I'm curious on why you think it's been so understudied compared to other areas in our field.
I am not sure. I think it's hard to wrap your head around why speech, language, and hearing should be at the table. Mm. But as much as I've been working in this area since the 1980s, and I took a small gap, and then 2000 I picked up again, and you know, every chance I get, I'm talking about it, I'm writing about it, I'm putting it out there, and there are a small handful of us, not very many, but I think it's just really hard to wrap your head around why would a speech-language clinician be involved with this population. Isn't that the domain of a psychologist or psychiatrist or social worker? And so, yes, I would say yes, it is. Mm-hmm. But also it should be the domain of a speech-language clinician. It should be the domain of an occupational therapist. It should be the domain of a counselor. Mm-hmm. The children is so complex. Mm-hmm. it requires more than one discipline. Mm-hmm. In the trauma clinic that I helped to co-found, we were a transdisciplinary team, and it was a social worker, a counselor, a pediatrician, a speech language clinician, occupational therapist, and we worked together, and I could not have understood any of it as I do now without that team. Mm-hmm. And so we should all be working in teams to understand this population and provide support. There are, what I have found that when there are teams, they're seldom focused on children with trauma or individuals that have trauma histories or trauma experiences, that seldom is there a speech-language person involved. Mm-hmm. So if there is a team, it's usually psychologists, psychiatrists, social worker, occupational therapy even, mm-hmm. but somehow speech isn't always there. Mm-hmm. And if we're not invited to the table, speech-language people and hearing professionals, I want to encourage you to nudge yourself mm-hmm. and get at the table, because mm-hmm. we really need to be there.
Yeah. I mean, given all of your research on the pragmatic communication aspects, we should be there.
Yes.
But you're right. I get what you're saying. It doesn't come to the forefront initially.
No. Yeah.
I'm wondering, too, that mind shift that you mentioned earlier about what is wrong with you versus what happened. Mm-hmm. And I think the idea that you need this transdisciplinary team to address all aspects of the what happened. Mm-hmm. It seems more holistic approach.
Yeah.
So what kind of responses do you feel like when you're out encouraging?
I get a lot of positive responses. Mm-hmm. People are very interested, and they lack resources in terms of knowing what to do. And my knowledge is really deep in assessment. I have some interventions that I've developed, haven't published yet. And, you know, there's just so much need. There are other people who are actually doing some interventions. There's Anna Rupert, who is a speech-language clinician in Canada at the George Hull Center. And this is a whole center dedicated to children with trauma. And they are doing some initial, you know, thinking about intervention and testing out things there. And I'm sure there are others. Naama Yehuda, the author of Communicating Trauma, who's located in New York, which to date has been the only book-level treatment of trauma in language and communication so far. My book doesn't come out till July. So up to this point, hers has been the source, but she does a lot of intervention through her private practice. And so in that book, she writes a lot about some of the things that she has done. So it's just, but I get positive, people are very interested. So the American Speech Language Hearing Association, which we call ASHA, for the first time, it has a special topic interest for, not a topic interest, but a topic for the convention that for 2024 that will happen in December of this year, which is new. It's usually in November, but it's in December this year, focused on counseling, trauma-informed, and contextualized practice. So we will have some focus there, some focused presentations about trauma, which is exciting. So that's an exciting step to be taking.
And hopefully more publications come out of that conference as well.
Yes.
That's really exciting. I'm guessing you had a hand in shaping some of that.
Yes. Well, I'm a co-chair with Dr. J.J. Wicker of that topic committee.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Congrats on that.
Thank you.
So you've kind of described some of your experience working across disciplines. Can mm-hmm. you describe some of your interdisciplinary aspects of your research and how they've contributed to your work?
Well, everything, I've always, since 1984 when I had that transdisciplinary experience in the preschool classroom, I've been trying to recreate that in my life. And every single thing I do is mostly interdisciplinary. My work, my research, my writing. I belong to an equity action collective, which is a group of speech language scholars, and our role is to kind of push the envelope with the speech language discipline toward being more equitable and socially just, and critical, more critical theory as opposed to behaviorist theory, mm-hmm. Trying to move us more in that direction. But we do a lot of thinking together, a lot of writing together, planning together. We created a new journal. So the Journal of Critical Studies of Communication and Disability. And so everything, I feel most comfortable working in a team. Mm-hmm. And everything that I have done practically has been in the service of a team in some way. And it doesn't necessarily mean a team of speech-language clinicians or scholars. I have worked with political scientists, social workers. I've worked mm-hmm. a lot outside of speech-language hearing and with people in the health and education field, but also people in other, fields like mm-hmm. political science, politics, education, mm-hmm. Things like that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I can imagine that there would be policies that could be influenced by your research, too. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad to hear you're having those conversations with people who are experts in that area as well. What advice would you give to someone interested in pursuing research in trauma or in speech pathology or any of areas of your multifaceted research?
Well, I think people in trauma, there's information out there. There's very accessible literature. The Deepest Well by Nadine Burke Harris takes a really complex topic and makes it very accessible. So you don't have to know a lot about the brain. She talks about the brain in very accessible terms and in ways that trauma affects the brain, which is why then it affects language and communication. Although she doesn't write about that, she talks about the brain. There's Bessel van der Kolk, who is a psychiatrist, and his name should be familiar to anybody who's interested in trauma because he's very widely published and does a lot of research in that area. But he has his book called Body Keeps the Score. Mm-hmm. It's a very simply written, accessible book that talks all about the impact that trauma has on the body and why, even infants may not remember a traumatic experience, but it happened. Mm. They hold it in their bodies. Mm-hmm. And there are a couple of others that I was going to suggest. Mm-hmm. Okay, I mentioned Communicating Trauma already. There's Sensational Kids that's an occupational therapist book, but it's a good book to learn about how trauma impacts the regulation mm-hmm. system and why regulation is so important mm-hmm. for learning and literacy and executive functioning. Mm. And there's also a book called Politics of Trauma, where that's Sarah Haynes' 2019 publication. She talks about how that systemic piece, mm. how trauma can be systemic and be meted out by, sanctioned by society or the way society is mm-hmm. organized. Mm-hmm. So those articles, those books, and take as many courses as you can whenever there's, a trauma. I know Speech Pathology PD has offered a couple of things. I have an institute, which it can be found online, which has 8 modules.
Could you tell us the name?
Yes, it's called the Institute of Child Trauma and Communication.
Yeah. Great. Great, so we can find those modules.
Right, yep. So there are 8 modules, and I think people would find, who need an introduction, mm-hmm. Find them useful. I know that there's something called the state of Virginia has some modules online. I want to say Virginia. I'll have to get the name of it. It's slipping my mind.
Yeah.
But they have some modules online at state.
Nice. That's awesome that there's more resources out there for folks that are interested. Mm-hmm. What would you say is your favorite aspect of the work that you do?
I love the kids. It's just, well, you know, they're my heart. I'm also the preschoolers and, you know, that age range. So when I first, when the word trauma started being used, before it was severely emotionally disturbed, as if something was wrong with the children. Mm-hmm. So fast forward to 2000 when I started working in this trauma clinic, and we were talking about trauma and some of the things that were happened to the children. I was really, when we saw our first child, I was so nervous because what you read on paper, I was so afraid of what the child would be like, you know? Mm-hmm. And here comes this preschooler that is just a kid.
Yeah.
Right, carrying all of that. You would never know just to look, mm-hmm. right? And I think, I get goosebumps just talking about it, but I think that they can carry all of that and still be human and still be the children that they are. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just love them for that. Mm-hmm. And the second favorite thing would be the opportunity to work alongside with other people who are just as passionate about this topic as I am and trying to, you know, provide resources and figure things out together.
That's awesome. You're giving me goosebumps, too. If there's one key message you would like our listeners to take away from our conversation today, what would it be?
I think the message has to be that individuals who have trauma experiences are not bad people. They're not disturbed people. They're not broken people. They are trying to survive, and we have a responsibility to work with them to help them do that.
Awesome. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Heider and Dr. Gladfelter, for being here today.
Thank you so much.
And discussing this really important topic.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This has been Sizel Presents, a language and literacy podcast. Thank you for listening. Sizel Presents is brought to you by the Center for the Interdisciplinary Study of Language and Literacy at Northern Illinois University. Music was performed by the NIU Steel Band, arranged by Yuko Asada.